Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty. We're the Armstrong and Getty Show.
We cover the stories the mainstream media ignores.
Stories that are important to your life and important to the world.
The election, of course.
The many trials of Donald Trump.
Couple of wars.
Gender-bending madness.
Why are kids looking at so much social media?
And we bring you the stories the mainstream media is on.
But we do it without the left-wing media spin.
Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Open your free iHeart app and search the Armstrong and Getty Show to start listening.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Brute force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, Special Operations Military News, and straight talk with the guys in the community.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to Soft Web Radio. Soft Web Radio on time, on target. And that's a very apt description of who we have here with us today. So, we have some great guests with us today, and it's a book that I guarantee that all of our listeners and readers out there are going to want to check out. And it's called Never Mind, We'll Do It Ourselves. And it's about this. It's a true joint mission. I mean, you have Air Force, CIA, Army guys, I think every other organization inside the United States government was involved in one point or another in this. And this was about the first drones that we used, UAVs, drones, however you wanted to call it, but how we got them armed for the very first time. And it wasn't an easy process and it wasn't overnight, but these guys got it done in kind of record time. We have Alec Bierbauer and Mark Cooter with us, and they just wrote the book, and we're going to talk about all of this. But before we do that, I want to welcome all you guys to the podcast, thanks for taking the time with us today.
Oh, thank you. We're eager to be able to tell the story.
Definitely.
And it's our pleasure.
Yep.
Because
appreciate it.
Yeah, let's fill our listeners in. Let's go back to the beginning of how this program got off the ground. And it was all the way back to the Clinton administration. And there was, I guess, some heartburn about assets on the ground in Afghanistan, which isn't an easy thing anyway, but can you fill our listeners in on some of the background on this?
Sure. No, I appreciate it. And so this is Alec talking, and the background of this really started from a presentation or a briefing that CIA Director George Tenet did to then President Bill Clinton, and Sandy Berger was the National Security Advisor at the time, and Richard Clark was the counterterrorism coordinator for the National Security Advisor. And while none of us were in the room for that presentation, afterwards it was clear that it didn't go particularly well. The topic was, we need to do more in Afghanistan. We need to do more to find bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, which at that time was not a particularly well-known problem set. So we're talking right at the end of 1999. And a memo at the time, a highly classified memo, got sent to the CIA and to the Pentagon with some very clear objectives of take CIA authorities, and that being a little bit more the Title 50 oriented authorities, but also presidential findings, and then take Pentagon technologies and resources, put them together, and see if you can do something. See if you can do something new, innovative. To find bin Laden was really the end state. And the only other hard constraint that was in the memo was we'd like this done by November of 2000. The memo came out in January 2000, so a 9-month timeline, which for any listeners that have been involved in program development or new systems development is that's the blink of an eye for getting something off the ground. So that was really the the kickstart for putting us in the room together and needing to come up with the capability.
Now, Alec, you were an Army warrant officer who was in intelligence, used to work with special forces guys, and then Mark was a Air Force officer. Now, Alec, when you were involved with this, were you still in the military, or were you working for the other government agency?
I started at DIA as a warrant, and then I transitioned into a government GS position, a government civilian position there. I was responsible for analyzing terrorism-related facilities worldwide, and at the time in the 90s, we were very focused still on Hezbollah and watching things in Lebanon and elsewhere. Didn't have deep knowledge on this, but then after the embassy bombings in 98, there was a strong effort to get DOD and in this case DIA and Joint Staff deeper into understanding actionable intelligence from CIA. And at the time, CIA's Counterterrorism Center had phenomenal analysts and core collectors, but supporting the military and that targeting process was certainly not a strong suit. So I worked in a joint cell. I was detailed to CIA first from DIA, and then transitioned and became a staff officer and a case officer at CIA. But yeah, absolutely came out of the military and was one of the few people at CTC, Counterterrorism Center, that as they said it, spoke Pentagon language, which is how I got tasked with the role of being the program manager from the agency side.
Yeah, you mentioned the Tanzania bombing, and it seems like yesterday when that happened, and looking back on it now, it's like 23 years ago. I mean, it seems like a blink of an eye, but up until that point, I think for most Americans, we had never heard of Al-Qaeda up until probably that time frame.
Yeah.
But
yeah, no, Absolutely. It was in the mid 90s, Bin Laden was, you know, sitting in Sudan, in a relative safe haven. He had fought in Afghanistan during the war, with the Russians, or proxy war, in Afghanistan. But certainly was not the household name, certainly in the late 90s or even into 2000. The embassy bombings in Tanzania and Kenya were probably the first events that put him on the radar for a lot of folks.
So how did this project get started? I mean, we know the background of, you know, they were looking for, more actionable intelligence in Afghanistan, which is, you know, at that time, the agency was heavily into human. And as we all know, the average American doesn't blend in well in Afghanistan territory. So you happen to rely on local sources, which it's harder to control when you don't have that kind of background there. So how did this entire project get started from your guys' standpoint, and how did you all get thrown together in this?
Yeah, let me set the stage for the getting to the technology piece, and I'll turn it over to Mark. But after we got the memo I mentioned earlier, and we had a planning meeting, Charlie Allen, who was the assistant director of Central Intelligence for Collections at the time, and a real legend in the intelligence world, said, you know, go down to the Pentagon, find the right folks, let's get this thing put together. And we set some constraints, some planning assumptions. We knew we had the 9 months. We knew we were going to leverage DoD assets. We knew our human, as you mentioned, our sources on the ground were not able to give us actionable intelligence. And in this context, actionable intelligence, and this becomes really important later on, is that the requirement was to put U.S. eyes on target, have a U.S. person, trusted, vetted, cleared, understanding the full consequences of their findings and reports, putting their eyes on Bin Laden. And we knew we couldn't do that on the ground with the sources that we had. We didn't have Americans running around in those parts of Afghanistan. And so we opted to find a technical solution, we modified the phrase a little bit, to put technical U.S. eyes on target, figuring it really didn't matter if those eyes were, you know, a couple thousand miles away looking through a camera on a drone, or whether they were on the ground. And the Pentagon, you know, extremely receptive. The J3 and the J2 for the Joint Staff were deeply involved. That's where we wound up on the Joint Staff side. On the Office of the Secretary of Defense side, we were dealing with Dr. Chuck Perkins and Alex Lovett, who were running advanced concepts or advanced technology demonstrations, basically science projects for OSD. And one of those science projects that Alex Lovett turned us on to when we started having discussions with the Pentagon was Predator as a capability that, you know, Mark was operating just prior to that in Bosnia. Mark, you want to pick it up on the Predator side?
Sure. First of all, as Alec alluded to, up until we first met, 3 months before that, I was at then Indian Springs Airfield in Nevada, now called Creech Air Force Base, where we had operated the Predator. I was a major at the time and had been the operations officer for the first squadron that we had of Predators. I had moved then to the Pentagon, and I was doing doctrine stuff at the Pentagon, hating life, when I got a call that says, hey, you're dropping everything and you're going to be involved in this program. I think we got to set the stage that at that point in time, you know, the concept for Predator was we would deploy a bunch of people forward, like Alec mentioned in Bosnia, set up right in basically in the middle of the target area or close to it when we started doing Kosovo, and everything would be there at the site. Well, the first thing we learned was we weren't going to be able to do that based on what Alec talked about. So we were going to do a technological leap where we were going to have a small footprint forward at a launch site, and then we were going to via satellite pipe the information back somewhere else, and that's where the operational team would be. That's where we'd have all our intelligence support, weather support, the linkages to Alec and his team to do that. So that was the first technological leap that everybody, you know, it's kind of just, you know, it's like nothing today. But then it was like, we're going to do what? You know, Alec.
Right, that wasn't even, I'm sorry to interrupt, but Mark, but at that time, I mean, even the people that designed Predator never really envisioned this kind of a scenario, did they?
Absolutely not. And in the book, because of some sensitivities, there's a gentleman in there named Albert, also known as the man with two brains. Without him, none of this would have been possible, because he and some of our other contractors came up with the technology to do that, to bounce the satellite. And to be honest, when we first started operating over Afghanistan, the link at our takeoff location was terrible, to where we would have to set it so that it wouldn't try to return us back all the time. And, you know, Albert was like, it will get better over the target area. Trust me. We kind of had to trust him. And Alec was like, Mark, how do you know if this is going to work? And I was like, Alec, if we click on the link and we see video and my team can move the stick and it makes the camera move and the control surfaces on the airplane move, I will be confident that we can do this. But until that point, I'm not sure. I got the first that call in June of 2000. And oh, by the way, it was, we're going to do this and you have to have a demonstration in less than a month and then deploy in 2 months on unproven technology against this high problem set. You have no squadron. You have to figure out the team and set it up, and you have no location. You got to figure that out. And you're going to link with the agency, which we've never done before. And that's kind of where, you know, Alec and I first met each other in a meeting in the Pentagon. And, you know, I was like, who's the young kid here? Well, he's going to be the guy in charge. Wow.
That's amazing. And, you know, the fact that you guys were even able to get your entire team put together in that short amount of time and accomplish the things that you did, it's pretty amazing.
Well, I think it's the testament, and I think part of it was goodness on the leadership and their ability, or them allowing us to pick, kind of handpick the team. And two, it was kind of luck, because you can look at our team, whether it's contractors or enlisted or officers. So across the gamut, from our pilots, our sensor operators, Alec's team, the imagery folks that were supporting Alec, our intelligence people, our weather people, and certainly our communications people, we had some, they were all go-getters. They never took no for an answer. And that's really what, you know, it wasn't Alec and I that made all this happen. It was the people on our team. And then we were certainly lucky to have some good leadership that gave us a lot of rope, but didn't let us hang ourselves.
And things didn't go smoothly at first. I know I read in the book that, you know, you had some problems. Obviously, you're starting a program where you're asking this device to do things that hadn't been envisioned before. You actually had a crash on one. Can you talk to our listeners about that?
I'll start it off, and then I'll let you tell, because yeah, you had to deal with the ramifications. So we had some, normally you take the aircraft out of the coffin, as we call it, put it together, and the first thing you do is a functional check flight. the process in those days was you did that only during the day. And that way you could test everything. You didn't have but one camera to use, et cetera. Well, because of some of our requirements from our host nation, we had to do it at night. And I don't want to make this sound like I blame the contractors or whatever, but they were doing their best. They didn't have a full team forward. And there were the camera did what it was supposed to do based on the mode they had it in, and it caused the pilot to get disoriented, and he basically reacted to what he was seeing, which caused the airplane to basically flip and destroyed on our, it was our first flight. So Alec, I'll turn it over to you because you were the one who had to deal with the funness there.
So I got a new appreciation that night for the reason the Air Force has checklists and pilots use checklists to go through things. And it was our requirement, you know, and based on dealing with the host nation on, you know, by its very nature, it's hard to have a clandestine airfield, but we gave it our best shot. And, you know, we weren't able to deploy the full complement that that certainly Mark would have been used to from his Bosnia days. And we set a head count at 10, where everybody's got at least 2-3 jobs to do. And that's everything from, you know, the guy in charge, you know, through the mechanics, the technicians, the pilots, sensors, security, medical, all had to fit into a 10-person package. And doing the flight at night, you know, and limiting it to one camera, it violated the Air Force approach to things, and we violated physics along the way. But it was a rough start. Having to brief my leadership on it, I was challenged to figure out how to paint this without getting the program shut down. So I think the quote I used was, you know, sir, I got good news and bad news, and the bad news is we crashed, but the good news is the pilot's okay. As a result, we were able to, you know, sustain that, and it became a budget fight later as to who was going to pay for it, but we were able to keep the program going. But that's the nature of an innovative effort. That's the nature of experimentation. As Mark said, you know, our leadership gave us good top cover guys like Charlie Allen and General Soup Campbell, giving us the support on the understanding the community and the DoD side. And, you know, my bosses at the time, Rich Blee, Copra Black, you know, same thing. But it was definitely a, you know, manage the message, as you briefed it.
Now, you know, I want to jump forward a little bit in the book because I think it was the summer of 2000, or maybe of September of 2000. You guys were already on station, and I think it was mission number 7 or 8, I think it was in the book. You can correct me if I'm wrong on that. You actually put eyes on Osama bin Laden, and that was an eyebrow raiser. I could tell my eyebrows went up when I read that, because they gave you a mission, and in less than the time frame, which was very short as it was, you guys accomplished what you set out to do right away. And talk our listeners through this. This was an amazing part of the book.
Yeah, I'll set the stage, but Mark, you can pick it up from after the man in white and what happened next. You know, the team effort to get to that point, yes, from the memo through to getting deployed, you know, the communications architecture that had to be put together, teaching imagery analysts that were used to looking at satellite imagery how to work in full motion video, which is, you know, commonplace today, but was unheard of at the time at the national level. You know, and then getting our collections managers to to integrate what we were learning from our human sources, our signals intelligence, our imagery, you know, the database that we had. You know, that day, that mission, it was mission eight, started as a, it was a Friday, and we had a report suggesting that bin Laden might be in the area outside of Kandahar, known as Tarnak Farms. And when we had watched Tarnak Farms for quite a while, with satellite to understand, you know, what it was, where it was. And then one of our planners, you know, brought up the fact that, hey, Friday prayers, you know, if we're going to see them, you know, let's make sure that we're on station, prior to, you know, Friday prayers, and let's look for what that location might be, and then start looking for, what might constitute a, you know, a security profile, for them. So we planned the whole mission against that. We got down by Kandahar, got over Tarnak Farms, and, you know, we call it the man in white scenario, but, you know, tall guy walks out of a building, everybody stops what they're doing, shows deference. It was just amazing to watch it in real time. I mean, nobody had seen bin Laden, and, you know, in a fine fix type of scenario, or, you know, isolating into a specific point on the globe in a specific time, since it had been probably 5 years. It was probably at some point in Sudan. So it was success. You know, we put U.S. eyes on target. And I'll let Mark pick it up from there.
Well, you know, for us sitting at the real tactical level, we had, you know, Alec had given us direction. We had to do our best to avoid being detected going into country. So we had figured out what the radars were doing for the Afghans, which ones were up, which ones were down, what routes to get in. We had worked our way all the way to Kandahar. They had radar guided SAMs. We had done our best to be able to be mindful of those, as well as MiG aircraft. And we did that. And, you know, we knew, I think we were confident, all of us, that if we could link up Alec's human intelligence and other intelligence sources and our ability to get over target, that we could be successful. And sure enough, you know, we get over the area. There wasn't a lot of activity there, but all of a sudden we see more vehicles around the surrounding area that, as Alec mentioned, looked like a security setup. And, you know, it's around time people are going to meet, and there's a bunch of people there huddling around. And next thing you know, out of what was identified to us as his probable residence, out comes the man who's definitely taller than everybody else. He's in white. People are deferring to him, etc. And of course, for us, what had been briefed was, we get actionable intelligence, they're going to go after him with the means we had at the time. And that's where, in the book, there's some colorful dialogue between our liaisons, between Alec and I, who had the worst job because they had to work between Alec and I. And then Alec and I on, okay, we did our part, you know, is a sub in the basket so we can launch a missile. And then that's when we learned that that what we had been briefed, what Alec had been briefed, wasn't actually going to happen. I'll also say, shortly after that, another problem arose, and that was we got indications that there was that they knew there was something up in the air, and they were going to launch a MiG aircraft after it. So it got really interesting after that. But I mean, we had put eyes on, and done our job.
Yeah, and that was the amazing part of the book, because this was a full year before 9/11. It was before the Cole bombing. And, you know, it always, as a reader, it makes you wonder, and you mentioned it in the book, I mean, would the Cole bombing have happened? Would they have gone through with it? Would they have gone through with 9/11 if Bin Laden was taken out? And I think it's a fair question. And, you know, you have to stop and wonder about that. But, you know, reading that in the book, and you're talking about a full year before 9/11, they had the opportunity to take him out and they didn't take it. It makes you wonder what the thought process was in Washington at that point.
Go ahead, Alec.
We went through some couple of parallel issues in 98 after the embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania, because we wound up launching cruise missiles in Afghanistan and in Sudan. And because Afghanistan's a landlocked country and you're overflying, you know, Pakistan to get weapons on target off of the from ships, there's some political issues there. But, you know, frankly, we overcame that in the 98 scenario by just pre-positioning resources to make sure the Pakistanis didn't think it was an attack from India. And certainly all the mechanisms, you know, while in parallel with the technical development of the Predator program and building that team and putting all those pieces together, we were also working the, okay, what if we find him? What if we're successful? Then what? And that architecture was put into place. The resources were put into place. You know, there was no appetite for putting boots on the ground, which frankly was why we had an unmanned aircraft over. The shortest we could get the timeline was we put eyes on target, and then you just got, you know, flight time for getting weapons on target. And, you know, whether, you know, obviously, you know, now it's history, and, you know, the threshold for pulling the trigger on that was not met. Whether it was, you know, set up and viable, yeah, all the pieces were in place. But from a political perspective, you know, the decision makers didn't see fit to pull the trigger that day. And whether the expectation was if we can do it once, we can do it again. You know, we obviously continued. We did another 7 flights, I think, in 2000 before we shut down, primarily because of weather constraints through the winter. And we're going to use that time to reset and go back in 2001.
I would say from a personal perspective, I whether it's a character flaw or whatever, I don't tend to I've kind of found my own mechanism for not doing the look back on, you know, coulda, shoulda. But I would also say, you know, at the time, while there was a lot of frustration over those last 7 missions that Alec mentioned, especially after the coal, I think the team became resolved that we needed to do the next step. We proved what we could do, and maybe we need to do more. That's kind of where our motto and the title of the book started. Never mind, we'll do it ourselves. And then really allowed us to start thinking about arming the Predator, because I think, you know, you could look at it also, had we not, had that situation not occurred, while I still think we would eventually arm the Predator, I don't think we would have done it as fast without the resolve of the people on the team to do it ourselves.
That was leads me into the next part, which is, it was fascinating, because we're so used to hearing about the Predator and being armed today. We take it for granted that, you know, it was always that way, but it really wasn't. And again, the folks who built it said, you know, it wasn't constructed for that. They basically said, well, you know, let the buyer beware if, you know, anything goes wrong with this. Can you talk our listeners briefly through how you guys got to this realization, okay, we're going to arm the Predator, how you went about it, and, you know, all the work that went into this?
So from an agency perspective, we accepted and in fact there were requests from, you know, from my leadership on, you know, what else can we do? You know, can we arm it? There was a healthy discussion about can we even just crash Predator in the bin Laden if we find him again. And you know, obviously the safety mechanisms that were built into the communications in the aircraft would largely prevent us from doing that. And I don't know that we would have gotten the kinetic effects that we wanted anyway. But so the kind of on the long-term planning process from the Air Force side, there was a discussions about arming it at some point. And you know, just to show you how naive I was at the time, you know, when we found out we only had a 100-pound payload capacity on the wings, you know, we went back to manufacturers and the Air Force, and they're like, yeah, we put about 100 pounds on there. But you know, there was no adapter. You know, that didn't exist. There was a reasonable fear that launching a missile off of the wing would potentially take the wing off the aircraft. In fact, I think we got a picture in the book. It's on our website too. With you know, the first launch was off of a Predator set up on a pedestal, just to see what the effects would be on the aircraft. But you know, my naive approach was, well, if we only got 100 pounds, I want, you know, 98 pounds of high explosives and 2 pounds of wrapper. And then once we started looking into it, and I got a rapid education on high explosives and weapon systems, you know, we went to Redstone Arsenal in Huntsville and started talking to the experts about, you know, what can we do with 100 pounds and Hellfire. Got put on the table pretty quick. And, you know, I felt like we were wasting a lot on fuel, but you know, turns out it was a really good weapons choice from a getting a weapon on target. You know, the testing process, you know, I think what 60 days and $500,000, Mark, to prove that that we could shoot Hellfires off a Predator.
Well, that's what I had to put on the PowerPoint slide in the Pentagon, because that's what they could sell. It ended up being a little bit more than that, but that's how staff work goes.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty. We're the Armstrong and Getty Show.
We cover the stories the mainstream media ignores.
Stories that are important to your life and important to the world.
The election, of course.
The many trials of Donald Trump.
Couple of wars.
Gender-bending madness.
Why are kids looking at so much social media?
And we bring you the stories the mainstream media is on.
But we do it without the left-wing media spin.
Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Open your free iHeart app and search the Armstrong and Getty Show to start listening.
that's how things work, and you have to do what you have to do. And so then you guys went out to was it China Lake that you went out to and tested it and went through a bunch of various scenarios, increasing the altitude and whatnot, because I remember reading in the book as well that the Hellfire wasn't even designed to be shot at that altitude. It was actually a low-level missile, correct?
Yeah, it was an Army weapon designed mostly for helicopters to
shoot Napa the Earth and against at low altitude against those targets. So, you know, the first thing we had to do was, first off, you know, that missile is because of that, they built the logic in the missile to climb an altitude to get over terrain and everything else and to give it what we call G bias to hit the target. So the first thing we needed them to do is, you know, figure out how to fake it out or change the software, and they didn't want to change any software. So we had to redesign some things to fake it out. And then we were like, okay, well, it's used to a few hundred feet. What's it going to do when we put it up at 20,000 feet? You know, is it actually going to be able to make it? Is it going to, if we do it for 20 hours up at that altitude, is it going to do what we call cold soak and the electronics not work? And the only way to know that is to do some testing. And we did minimal testing to give us at least some level of confidence to do that. But it was certainly, I mean, the work from Redstone Arsenal, as Alec mentioned, Big Safari, the rapid acquisition arm for the Air Force, and General Atomics and other contractors. It was a team effort to get that accomplished. We would do software changes like daily to make that happen. We had a new sensor ball that we were using. So it was a lot of unproven. A lot of things had to happen right for that to happen.
But if I could just add in, I think this is a fact, or at least what I was briefed on at the time from the Army side, was that, you know, Lockheed, that makes Hellfire, said that if we took it to 20,000 feet, we were voiding the warranty, and they wouldn't accept responsibility for that. But it goes to you know, just that technology challenge of, you know, hey, it's designed for a 5,000 foot and you're taking it to 20, hadn't done it before. I think, you know, the test went reasonably well. Mark and I may have, you know, highlighted the success and mumbled through the, you know, the failures a little bit as we briefed it, but I think by the time we got through the test, we were I was convinced that you know, this is definitely what we had to go with. And yeah, within the span of a couple of months, we had answered that subsequent call of you know, giving a weaponized capability to the same platform.
Yeah, I mean, you got to look back on it. You know, the Air Force, the first test, you know, February, March kind of time period. And our last test, I believe we're in the June, maybe July time period. And that was the kind of the last ones were kind of a dress rehearsal, keep it airborne for 20 hours, look at stuff and then take the shot. That was kind of the culmination that we were like, when we got to that point, I think we felt we had a good capability that if we had another opportunity, we would have the mechanism to deal with the target.
And then jumping forward, just a couple of months after your last test, 9/11 happens. You guys described, you know, watching it from various perspectives in the book unfold. And it's amazing that you got orders and you guys went wheels up and a very, very short amount of time. Can you talk our listeners through that and, you know, how you got set up back in Afghanistan again?
While we were, you know, all, I think, like every American, watching and experiencing the effects of what was happening that day, you know, and I look back over it years later, and I was like, we, as helpless as we felt, as beaten at that particular moment as we felt, we actually had something to do. We had, you know, much like first responders did, much like, you know, military, you know, would start activating and turning things on. You know, it was actually between the two towers falling that Snake Clark, you know, an institution within the Air Force, called me, and all he said is, "What do you need?" And You know, and keeping in mind every aircraft in the nation was grounded or being grounded at that point. And, you know, I didn't have the authority to tell him to do anything in particular, but I'm like, we gotta go. He started turning on aircraft and whatever magic he was able to do to get aircraft flying within hours. And Mark, your guys got picked up right out in California, grabbed some Hellfires on the way, dropped some stuff up in DC and headed over, right?
Yeah, I mean, when you look back on it, certainly, you know, we have been waiting for this moment, not for 9/11, but to redeploy. And there was, you know, the political arms had to figure that out. So we had leaned forward in the saddle as far as we could. We had already moved a ground control station to a new location. We had done everything we could. So it was certainly, once 9/11 happened, we were certainly able to lean forward faster than most others. But, you know, to the tribute to our folks, you know, I was getting calls, you know, people all over. One of my guys was in Okinawa, station there. We had folks up in Alaska. We have folks, you know, on vacation that were calling in. The squadron commander, Ed Boyle, was actually temporary duty in Arizona and had to drive back nonstop to get us going. So everybody was working hard, and you know, you'll read about it in the book. But I remember at one point I was a major at the time, and I told Alec, I said, I've done more than I'm supposed to as a major. I probably need to call one of the bosses to make sure. And I got clearance to do that. And then, you know, I remember calling out to my former squadron commander out at Indian Springs and said, "Hey, sir, I need the following individuals to figure out a way to get to California to meet airlift because I got a mission that I need them to do." And he was like, "You know, I'm not going to get a formal message on this, am I, Mark?" And I'm like, "No, sir." But General Fuglesong, then A3 equivalent, is fully aware and needs you to do it. He's like, "They'll be there." But he also said, if anybody else would have called me, I'd have hung up on him. So
yeah, I remember that's how we got the team.
You know, 12 September, we were running, and then we actually did our first flight into Afghanistan on the 17th.
That's amazingly fast. And, you know, I know you guys, being in the Pentagon, in the agency, you all knew people that were impacted by 9/11. I mean, I think everybody did. And then the war hit home right after you guys were in Afghanistan. I know Alec lost a good friend, Mike Spann. Mark, you knew Jefferson Davis from high school. I knew him very, very briefly in Special Forces. I remember touching base with him a couple of times in passing. And when I read about that, it's amazing how small the world is, isn't it?
Yeah, it was kind of surreal. It definitely hit home. I mean, he and I had graduated high school together. We spent all of our high school years together. My dad had retired, and I moved back to Elizabethan, Tennessee. And you know, my brother had called me and said, "Hey, did you see that? What happened to Donnie?" And I didn't. And then I saw it, and I'm like, "Holy cow!" Because we had supported. I didn't know we had. I didn't know he was on the ground with the team, but we had supported his team as well as others on numerous occasions. And it just happened to be that day we didn't. So it's another one of those coulda, shoulda, woulda, because there were definitely other times that we helped out when there were coordinating issues, et cetera. So it was a tragic loss, but it gave me an opportunity as a leader to remind people on from a personal way, why we were doing what we were doing, and that we would do everything we can to make sure incidents like that didn't happen anymore. So it was tragic. It was tragic for Mike Spann as well. So.
Alec?
Yeah, I remember the Mark, your pre-mission brief after Davis was killed. You know, I think he brought in his, he had his picture there, and I mean, there was nobody on the team that was in any way wavering in their support for the mission, be it in 2000 or 2001. It, you know, it was not hard to organize and move the team forward. You know, when you said, you know, our mission is to go find Bin Laden, you know, and that was in 2000, and I don't even know that anybody talked about the mission in 2001. It was pretty clear. But you know, we had, you know, on the Air Force side, you know, there were dozens of people supporting. On the agency side, dozens of people supporting. You know, be it in DC, overseas, at contractor facilities, down at Redstone, at Big Safari, in Dayton, Ohio. I mean, there were people supporting the program everywhere. And what was amazing is, you know, that there was no lack of motivation. And one of the requirements that we, from the agency side, put on whenever we had people come into CIA headquarters was, we didn't want the military uniforms there. We didn't want to change our profile, even within our own community at headquarters. This was a very compartmented program, but I can't tell you, you know, who on the team definitively was a contractor versus a government civilian versus a uniformed military enlisted or officer. And I also couldn't tell you the rank of most of the people that were supporting. They were all just teammates, and they were all there. And it, you know, in some cases it was very junior enlisted guys that were, you know, providing input, you know, be it technical, weather, operational, collections management, that, you know, their contributions were, it really didn't matter who it was coming from. We were taking their guidance, and we were innovating on the fly to get this done. But when you do see the losses, you know, Mike Spann and Davis being two of them, you know, Mark was on the ramp at Ramstein after the coal, saw the procession of hearses after that. You know, it definitely strengthens your resolve, and it gives you, you know, an enhanced sense of mission and purpose, that we truly were empowered and charged to try and make a difference. And I think that motivated us daily.
And then, you know, once you guys were on the ground, you started actually running missions, and it everything that we're used to seeing today now kind of happened. I'm not going to say all at once, but it was a gradual thing from reading in the book, but it kind of all fell into place during the Battle of Roberts Ridge. Can you talk our listeners a little bit through that and explain, you know, the situation on the ground and how it all came to be?
Well, all I'm going to say is the same thing that I said on that day when Mark contacted me. I was at headquarters. He was in the GCS. He's like, we think we got troops in contact. And I said, CIA is getting out of the way. You know, go direct to them and do what you need to do.
You know, the tough part for Anaconda, first off, the major operation, you know, we on the Air Force side and Alec on the agency side knew there was a big operation coming on, but, you know, we struggled to get into the planning stuff. So I think on that day we were just running a mission from a collection deck that Alec had us on, and just happened, luckily, we were up in the general vicinity when it happened. Our pilots immediately were working to try to get through airspace to get near the what was going on, to see if we could help. We were contacting the command and control entities to see what we could do to help. Our enlisted sensor operators were scanning to see what they could find, and frankly, just happened the greatness of one of our sensor operators, a staff sergeant at the time, now a chief master sergeant, came across a helicopter and, hey, let me follow this. And it ended up being the helicopter that ended up hard landing, getting rocket attacked on it, or rocket fired on it and impacting on the ground. And then we subsequently stayed overhead doing with a lot of coordination, that's for sure, because at the time, a lot of people didn't want us there. But we stayed overhead for the better part of 15 hours. Made contact with Gabe Brown, the combat controller on the ground, explained who we were, and then proceeded to help him as best we could, and not inundate him to include danger close Hellfire shots. But I think Gabe stuck it out there a little bit because I'm not sure that the leadership there were convinced that we could do it safely. But I think Gabe had confidence. And then did that. And, you know, Gabe has subsequently told me that if we hadn't fired that Hellfire missile, we thought he would have been dead 15 minutes later. So after that, we did everything we could to, you know, I remember, you know, this isn't in the Air Force doctrine book, but I told my guys, I said, I want bombs on that mountain all night. I don't care what it is. I said, clear friendlies from it. And just so that the friendlies on the ground know that air power is still above them. And that, that the bad guys know that there's air power still above them and are looking to do it. So we buddy lays for other aircraft to include some French aircraft and, stayed overhead until those guys were finally off the mountain.
Yeah. I remember there was a portion in the book where, you know, Gabe Brown was probably juggling all kinds of air assets, you know, at the same time. And he mentioned you guys. He says, I don't know, even I'm paraphrasing here, but I think he said something to the extent of, I don't even know who the hell these guys are, but they've been saving my butt all night. So that had to have been pretty sweet to hear back in, you know, for your operators and your, you know, guys back at headquarters.
Yeah. It's still emotional to this day. Got a chance to myself to finally see Gabe in person at John Chapman's Medal of Honor ceremony at the Air Force Memorial. So,
and he's a lieutenant colonel now, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and at that time he was a staff sergeant.
Yep.
So yeah, he's made it up through the ranks. And I remember reading that entire story, and it's a tremendous story. Before I even knew about your guys' involvement in that, I mean, hearing the story from their perspective on the ground and then reading your guys' story, it's an amazing feat. I think it shows the best of what we are as Americans. And it was an amazing night, I guess, for those guys. And the fact that he got them through it and was able to save all those guys, and they finally got their people off the mountain. And, you know, reading the book about how Al-Qaeda tried to, you know, reinforce, and they were bombing them all night long. It was a moving part of the book for sure. And
yeah, and Steve, ahead. there was a remarkable part to that story as well. The duration of this was such a long thing. Like you say, it was going on all night. And of course, aircraft are constrained by fuel. And, you know, while Predators got a long lifetime comparatively, it's still finite. And these guys did something else during that night that was an amazing thing, is that while the first Predator was over target area and the crew was learning everything and getting it all, a second crew was flying a second Predator in on target. So by the time the first one was hitting that bingo point that it had to turn around and fly out, the two crews literally did a Chinese fire drill, if you will, running out of one GCS, running to the other, so that they, you know, it, metaphorically, the pilots passing as plane pass leap from one plane to the other. So the crew that had all the on-ground experience and eyes on suddenly had a fresh plane with fresh fuel, because they'd made a promise to them. They said, we're going to stay here with you guys till we get you off that thing. And because, again, because of the uniqueness of what Predator was, they were able to keep that promise.
That's a great point. And I've been remiss because when you guys wrote the book, and years later, your author is also with us, Michael. Michael Marks is here with us. And that was Michael who just spoke. So we're going to get I'm going to ask you another question here in a minute, Michael. But I wanted to go right back to the guys. And you all met years later at the Air and Space Museum. And your original Predator is now in the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum. Is that correct?
Yeah, we, I think maybe even as, if it wasn't the next year after I had left in 2002, but pretty close to that, I kind of started sending out an email every 9/11 to everybody I had a email address for on the team. And then we, years later, we decided to do reunions every now and then. And we finally got a chance to do one there at the Air and Space Museum. So that was kind of interesting. You know, we all got a little heavier, a little grayer, except for Alec. And it's kind of been a tradition for us since then.
So you guys decided to write a book after you were retired. I remember reading that part of it. How long did this take before you actually started putting pen to paper? I know it took a long time to get it cleared by the agency, but how long did it take to, you know, put this all together? And how did you guys come to meet Michael?
Well, I'll start that one out. it was actually Mark and I joked that we'd either be sharing a jail cell together one day, or we'd write a book together one day. And luckily, we wrote a book. But we started pulling together notes years ago, but wanted to wait until, you know, Mark was retired. We wanted to wait until, you know, the relevance of the TTPs, the tactics, techniques, procedures we were using in 2000, 2001 were closer to history than day-to-day operations. And and as we started pulling notes together, we realized that we were trending towards a fairly dry academic textbook approach to telling a little piece of history. And you know, Michael, who I had been working with at that point for a couple of years, you know, it was he was a brother right out of the gate when we met. And Mark asked me, he's like, is anybody gonna be interested in publishing this book or reading this book? And I think we accepted the answer was probably gonna be no. And we pulled in Michael, who had done some writing. And I mean, the writing part at that point was really his burden. You know, Mark and I had the notes to start from, but then we started telling stories. And you know, to Michael's credit, even during the reunions that Mark was talking about a minute ago, you know, Michael attended one, I don't know, probably 4 years ago now, and started interviewing other members of the team. It came together. You know, we set kind of a beginning and a cutoff for the period of the book, and you know, it was a daunting process for me and probably for Mark, and I think Michael made it look easy.
Well, Michael, asking you, I mean, there were so many people involved in this. How difficult was it to put all this together? And let's face, like Alec was just saying, I mean, a lot of it could have ended up being very dry technical stuff, but you weaved the story around all of this and made it, I like I said at the outset of the podcast, this was a page turner. How difficult was it from your perspective?
You know, it really wasn't very difficult at all. If you look, you know, history is made up of facts, but stories are made up of people. Mm-hmm. And Alec and Mark both out of the gate said, listen, this is, you know, we're not trying to tell a story of how a bunch of carbon fiber and aluminum and titanium parts went together. This is the people. And they said, you know, we want to make sure that this group of patriots is recognized. And there was a lot of love and affection and brotherhood and all this. And they were so passionate about it. And then I got to meet the rest of the crew and they were all the same. I was sitting here at a reunion, and I got, you know, a dozen folks sitting around me in a circle, and any one person given the chance to, you know, kind of soak up the limelight for a minute, the first thing they said is, oh, I was just flying the plane. This guy was lasing, but the laser guy's going, oh no, I was just doing that. But you know, the comms that were coming, I mean, everybody was just handing off the ball. And it felt very much to me like that sort of sentiment that you hearken back to, like a band of brothers mm-hmm. kind of feeling. And I said, you know what, all I got to do is be honest about this. Tell the story in the first person, tell it through the voices of Alec and Mark, because that seemed kind of interesting as you listen to it. And particularly sometimes when the, you know, they're both talking about the same moment, but they're talking about it from two completely opposite sides, the agency side versus the Air Force side. But I said, you know, this is the, at least for me, what I felt the real challenge and what I thought I could bring to it was trying to let people experience the story the way I was, to feel like you're sitting around in a circle, you know, everybody drinking beers and going, oh, tell the story about the Mirage. You tell about Lucky the dog. And it was such a wonderful opportunity. Oh my God. It was
that was, yeah. I don't want to give too much of the book away because I want to promote it so our readers will buy it. But that was a great part of the story. I couldn't stop laughing over that because,
yep.
That was an aptly named dog, wasn't it? Lucky.
It absolutely was. So it was a great opportunity, and my hope was that people would come away from the book feeling like I did, like I got a chance to get to know some of these great people and, you know, see that they're just humble patriots who all of them said, look, all I did is did my job. And well, some of the fun characters, I mean, the Mark, you could share the Cliffy story on the, is this thing working as the rain was pouring down on the device, and, you know, things, I mean, these things that are as far from a Jason Bourne movie as you could possibly be.
Yeah, I thought, you know, the pull of the book was all this is going on. You have all these people involved in their vastly different perspectives because they're having to deal with different things. And you were able to weave that all together. But I thought it was a, excellent job on your part. I thought it was a great book, and I highly recommend this to all of our listeners and readers out there.
Well, thank you.
Fellas, is there anything coming up with the book where you guys are making? I know with the COVID, is there any appearances you guys are making on this?
Yeah, now you've hit the sore subject. You know, releasing a book during coronavirus may not be, you know, the best of choices, but after waiting 4 years, we weren't interested in letting it sit in the dark any longer. You know, we do have, but we don't have anything that is hard on the calendar, but, you know, we've had some discussions with the Smithsonian, and we're definitely eager to get in. Yeah, the aircraft that's hanging is tail number 34. It's one that we flew, and that's just, you know, the great center point for the story and the history, and the aircraft is exactly where it belongs. And, you know, if for nothing else, we're going to get there and at least get some pictures. You know, we also have interest in getting to the Air Force Museum, being able to do the same thing there. There's a great piece on Roberts Ridge, Operation Anaconda. And I think we potentially could add a couple of clarifying comments to that story as it's articulated there now, but that's another venue that we're looking at. And, you know, really anytime we can get any of the team together, for the next reunion. We're going to declare that to be our in-person kickoff, but everything else is just kind of constrained until we can start moving around a little bit more.
Yeah, hopefully that'll be real soon.
Absolutely.
But anyway, fellas, thank you very much. We really appreciate you taking the time with us this afternoon. Like I said, I wanted to discuss the book at length, but I didn't want to give too much of it away because we want our readers and listeners to go out there and buy it and support you all for that. And but it was a tremendous story, and we thank you, all three of you, for taking the time with us this afternoon.
Well, thank you.
It was our pleasure. But before we go, I just need to read something real quick for us. If you want to get SoftRep on your phone, download our free mobile app and get easy access to our articles, podcasts, and gear reviews, all perfectly formatted to your device. Please subscribe to SoftRep.com to get access to all our library of ebooks and our exclusive Team Room forums content. And it's available on all your Apple and Android devices. We want to thank everyone for listening this afternoon, and especially our three guests, Mark Cooter, Alec Bierbauer, and Michael Parks, for joining us this afternoon. It was a fantastic book. It's a great story. Hats off to all of you. Thank you for your service. Thank you for what you did for our fellow warriors out there. And God bless. And thanks again for taking the time and talking to us this afternoon, and filling in our listeners on your piece of the story.
No, thank you. Thank you for what you do. And thanks to your listeners for what they do. We appreciate them.
Absolutely.
Yep. Thanks a lot.
For all of us here at SoftRep Radio, myself, Steve Balstrey, all of our guests here, thanks for listening. We'll be back with another podcast real soon.
You've been listening to SoftRep Radio.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty. We're the Armstrong and Getty Show.
We cover the stories the mainstream media ignores.
Stories that are important to your life and important to the world.
The election, of course.
The many trials of Donald Trump.
Couple of wars.
Gender-bending madness.
Why are kids looking at so much social media?
And we bring you the stories the mainstream media is on.
But we do it without the left-wing media spin.
Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Open your free iHeart app and search the Armstrong and Getty Show to start listening.